Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to a special session of the IMGD speaker series. I'm Rob Lindemann, here to welcome you to the fun Monday session. Very happy so many people could come. Today we're very happy to have Michael Boyle joining us. Michael Boyle, game artist, has over 10 years of industry experience and has worked on numerous titles, including Warhawk, Twisted Metal, Head On, I was going to say Head On the Goblin, but and Goblin Commander is developed for most of the major platforms, including PS2, PS3, PSP, Wii, GameCube, Xbox, and PC. His responsibilities have ranged from interface design to texturing and modeling, but his true specialty is as an animator of characters and objects for both in-game and cinematic animations. Besides animating, he also enjoys creating versatile, animator-friendly rigs. So, Mike Boyle.
Thank you. Okay, I'll just apologize beforehand. I haven't really used PowerPoint before, so when I created this, I was hoping it would work. It doesn't exactly work. I'm going to have to do a little going back and forth from this presentation to my my movie files to show some of the examples that I wanted to demonstrate. Okay, what I wanted to talk about today was the 12 principles of animation and how they apply to games. I don't know how many of you are familiar with these 12 principles. I'll give you a little background information on the principles and how we use them in games. I personally find these principles very interesting. I hope that you will too. Okay. So, let's see. The 12 principles, they were originally developed by the early animators at Disney. They were developed between... Well, if you look at the history of Disney, I think it was 1930 when they did Steamboat Willie, and then you move forward to 1937, and that's when Disney did Snow White, and you see this huge leap in the animation quality. It's really amazing how much the animation quality improved from Steamboat Willie, where they did what's called rubber hose animation, to Snow White, where there's really true acting and a real performance in the animation. So I'll tell you a little bit about these principles and what they provide us as animators, first of all. The principles, there's 12 of them. They're techniques, methods, and concepts that we use in animation. They're time-tested because they've been used for years and years within traditional animation for film. They're also relevant to us in the game environment also. They're not software or tool specific, and that's one of the things I find very exciting about the principles, because as an animator, I know when I first started work as an animator, I learned how to use Studio 3D Max, and I thought, oh, I'm an animator, I can make things move. I really focused on the tool, but not really on these principles, which to me is the real knowledge of animation. You can learn tools, whether it's Maya or Studio 3D Max, or for that matter, stop motion, traditional animation. You can learn the tools pretty easily, but it's really these principles that are the true knowledge of animation. As I said, okay, these principles can be applied to traditional animation, stop motion, and CG animation. These principles, they're going to seem very simple and obvious to you, I believe. You'll think, well, that's obvious, no big deal there. While they're very simple, they're really hard to put into practice. At least that's my experience. I think that's most animators' experience, that they find these principles are very simple, they seem very obvious, but then when you actually try to put them into practice, it's a little more difficult. So, the principles. Here are the 12 principles that we use in animation. These are the principles that were developed by the Disney animators during the so-called golden age of animation. We've got timing, squash and stretch, slow in, slow out. Anticipation, follow through, overlapping action, arcs, straight ahead, pose to pose, solid posing, secondary animation, staging, exaggeration, and appeal. I don't know, are any of you familiar with or heard of these 12 principles before?
The artist.
The artist, okay. So I think that, I hope that afterwards all of you will be able to appreciate animation a little bit more, because you'll understand a little bit more about what you're seeing when you understand these principles. You understand, you know, what's going on behind animation, whether it's in games or whether it's on TV or in a film. What do the principles provide the animator? Well, first of all, I think that they give us as animators a common language that we can speak to one another when we want to discuss an animation, whether it's critiquing an animation. This is the language that we use. It gives us a way to pinpoint where there's a problem in an animation. You know, if you can kind of use it as a list. If there's something that's not quite working with your animation, then you can kind of go through this list and think, okay, is it the timing? Let me take a look at the timing of the animation. Is that working? Okay, I think the timing is okay. Maybe I need to look at anticipation. Oh, there's the problem. To me, it's a good kind of checklist to go through to be able to fix your animations, to discuss your animations, critique animations. This is the language that we use. By understanding the principles, we can do more than just make objects move. We can really bring them to life. That's what I didn't understand when I first got into animation. I thought by knowing the tool, I was an animator. And as Richard Williams said, you don't know what you don't know. Richard Williams wrote a book that I'll talk about a little bit later, that if you find that you're interested in the subject, it's a great resource to learn more about what I'm going to be talking about. With these principles, these are the principles that we use to give characters a physical presence, whether they're old, young, heavy, light, feeble, strong. These principles allow us as animators to give characters these properties. These principles also allow us to give characters personality, whether the character is sneaky, pompous, shy, curious, whatever. It's through these principles that we're able to give characters their personality. Also, these principles allow us to give characters an emotional feel to them, whether they're sad, happy, angry, terrified, or whatever. These are the principles that we use to give characters their life. While the principles were originally developed for film animation, I believe that they're no less important to games. And games, however, are a very different medium, and because of that, they have their own challenges. I think that with games, oftentimes, as an animator, some of the differences from game animation and film animation are that in game animation, oftentimes, usually, you're not working with a fixed camera. So in film, you're working with a fixed camera. That allows you as an animator to really, you can do a lot of cheats, first of all. And you're really working to the camera. So you can get really strong silhouettes. It just makes it easier. Whereas a game animator, you don't know what angle necessarily viewers are going to see these animations in. The other difference, of course, is that in games, you have participants. People are really, they're participating in the gameplay. They are controlling the character, whereas in film, that's not the case. So because of these, I'm going to talk about a couple of, as we go through these principles, a couple of the challenges that we as game animators face, because, as I said, games are a very different medium than in film. Okay, so we'll start going through some of these principles. The first principle that we will talk about is timing. I'm going to show you a couple different examples of timing, and I think that through the examples, it'll become very clear what the concept is. Unfortunately, as I said in the presentation, I had it all set up so that I could just go through and it would immediately go to my examples. I'm going to have to find them, however, because it's not... not working for me. So, okay, timing. The first example I'm going to show you is, well, I won't tell you anything about it until you've seen it. Okay, there's a ball bounce. Let me play it one more time. Not a very good ball bounce. And the reason why is the timing. If you notice, the timing is very even. In fact, it's just very even timing, which is not what you would want with a ball bounce. You'd want with a ball bounce, the ball would, as it falls, it would build up speed. It hits the immovable floor, bounces very quickly out of it, and then slowly goes into its apex. So that's what the problem is here with the timing. Now, I think I have an example of where we can see the. Okay. Oh, I tried to open up the QuickTime. Okay, here's an example of better timing. And even just with the simple principle of timing, we immediately have something that's more interesting to look at and also has some personality. You can give even something as simple as a bouncing ball personality. The one other thing I should clarify with timing is that we're really talking about two different concepts here. We're talking about timing and spacing, because the two examples I just showed you in fact have the same timing. They both, on the same frame, are up at their apex, and at the same frame they hit the floor. But it's those periods in between where the spacing is different. I wish that I could show you on the board, but since we have the screen down, I can't really demonstrate that, but just so that you understand the concept. Actually, I've got some examples that I'll be able to illustrate that concept to you a little bit better. But that's what I'd like you to understand with those two examples, is that the difference really between those two in the timing is the spacing. They are spaced differently. I'll demonstrate this concept of spacing. Just remember that spacing is part of timing. Through timing, we can get the if the ball is, let's say, a bowling ball or a basketball or a beach ball, obviously they're going to react very differently. The timing and the spacing is what is going to give us that different feel. Okay, the second principle. Second principle I will talk about is squash and stretch. And you all are probably somewhat familiar with squash and stretch already. If you think about, for instance, old Tex Avery cartoons, he was an animator that was very famous for using a lot of squash and stretch and a lot of exaggeration. But even in more realistic animation, you want to use squash and stretch. Squash and stretch helps to describe a material, whether it's a very rubbery material, or Surprisingly, even something like a golf ball. I saw these pictures of a golf ball being hit with high-speed photography, and it's really fascinating to see how even a golf ball will squash considerably for just a very brief moment when hit by a golf club. Squash and stretch will make something feel more organic, and also depending on how much squash and stretch you're really dealing with, whether something is cartoony or realistic. The more squash and stretch you use, the more cartoony it's going to be. So for a game like Jack and Daxter or Ratchet and Clank, they might, something that's more cartoony, use some very cartoony squash and stretch, whereas with something that's a little bit more realistic, then you might not use a whole lot of squash and stretch. Let me show you an example. Again, a lot of the examples I'm going to show you are with a bouncing ball, but there's an example of a ball with a lot of squash and stretch, and it has a very rubbery quality, I think, because of the squash and stretch. Now, there are some game issues, at least that I have run across, when it comes to squash and stretch. When I've created a lot of rigs for characters and for vehicles in Warhawk or in the game I'm currently working on, and various other games. And sometimes squash and stretch in a game engine can be a little bit difficult because you're dealing with non-uniform scaling. And some game engines won't handle that. So sometimes you have to do some cheats and use translate information, and it doesn't come across as well. Just so that you're aware, sometimes squash and stretch can be an issue in a game engine.
Okay, can I ask a question? So can you explain that, what does non-uniform scaling mean?
Okay, non-uniform scaling. So in Maya or any other 3D package, you have of course translate, rotate, and scale. For objects. And with translate, you can, as you probably are all aware, you have X, Y, and Z axis, which you can move objects in. For rotation, you also have X, Y, Z. Those are the different axes that you can rotate an object. Scale is the same thing, where let's say that I wanted to scale this water bottle here. Okay, so I want to scale the water bottle. In Maya, I have the Y axis pointing up. And if I wanted to scale it, if I wanted to scale it down in the y-axis, then it would, if I wanted to do squash and stretch on this water bottle, I could scale it down on the y-axis so that I'd make it shorter, and then scale it out on the z and the x-axis, which would make it fat. So that's what non-uniform scaling is, when you scale something in one direction on one axis and another direction on another axis, as opposed to if I were to just scale it uniformly, which would be to just scale this water bottle so it looked bigger, but it was the same proportions. So that's what non-uniform scaling is. And as I said, it's a problem in game engines. Can be. Currently, fortunately, with the game I'm working on now, it's not a problem. So it's really nice to be able to have that ability to do more squash and stretch. Okay. I got to remember to keep on going back and forth with this PowerPoint. The next principle I'll talk about is slow in, slow out. And this one, a lot of these principles really kind of overlap with one another, I should say. I think slow in, slow out, it overlaps a lot with the first principle that we talked about. I'll just talk a little bit about what slow in, slow out is. Almost everything, when like you move your arm, it moves a little more slowly, it speeds up, it slows down. That's all slow in, slow out is, really. It's just that things do not just and then hit a wall. Unless it's something very mechanical, then maybe it would. Like if it was some sort of mechanical arm or something like that, then maybe you would have it go a very uniform speed and then just stop immediately. But for a more kind of realistic and pleasant animation, you would want to apply this this technique of slow in, slow out. I'll show you a couple examples, a bad example and a good example of it. And let's see. Okay, slow in, slow out. Okay. I wish that I could play this in QuickTime because you can scrub through through an animation with QuickTime and it doesn't just go black like that. But okay, yeah. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, that'll be better. Yeah, unfortunately we got this flickering now, but what I'd like you to notice is that it's going at a very constant speed. There is no slow in, slow out. In fact, this is a better, this is an example where it's really probably better not to see it looping. I just wish it would stop at the last frame. I should have rendered these out so that I had some frames at the end. Okay, well, let me show you the spacing of this animation. Okay. Let's see. Can I? I'll just pause it there. Yeah, you can. Windows Media just does not scrub very well. It'll scrub a little bit, but with QuickTime you can really just scrub, and you can even go just frame by frame with it. So it's a lot better to use. Like when I'm working in Maya, we do play blast. This is a play blast from Maya. It's not a real render. It's just a quick play blast, and. I always do my play blast in QuickTime because I can scrub through it. It's just easier to work with than working within Windows Media Player. The thing I want you to notice here is what we had talked about before. We talked about timing and spacing. I wanted to demonstrate the spacing in this example because that's where you can see that there is no slow in, slow out. Each one of these dots here represents a frame. So I think in this case, I think I made this 24 frames long. And they're spaced very evenly, so it just moves at a very constant speed, and it doesn't slow into its stop. So it's not as pleasant as the next example I'm going to show you. Yeah, okay. Okay. I'll go ahead and repeat it. Again, this example, I'd rather not show it repeating because I really want you to notice how it comes to a nice slow stop and then stays there. But you can see that it speeds up at the beginning. It builds up speed, and then as it comes close to where it's going to stop, it slows down. And if we look at the spacing of it, you'll notice that, and this is exactly how traditional animators worked. They would deal a lot with the spacing. Traditional animators will make what are called key poses, and then what they would do typically is they would do the keys, and then they would hand it off to a person called an in-betweener. And we as computer animators, well, we have the computer do the in-betweens, except that you can never really trust the computer to do the in-betweens like you want it. So really, you do have to go through things frame by frame to get it like you want. In this example, though, it's pretty easy to do. You'll notice that in the beginning, the spacing is much closer together. It gets further and further apart as it speeds up, and then when it comes to the end, it slows down again. And And generally, you're going to want to do that in your animations. Any questions about anything up to this point? Yes?
I see rocket flies. Well, what is the point of this? Are you simulating the time rate of change of parallax when you're closer or further away?
Well, okay. Let me just tell you what we want to achieve with this. And that's basically just a more interesting, pleasant motion and something that is more more realistic. So if you're dealing with a character, or just about anything, really, almost everything is going to have this slow in, slow out. This is just one of those principles that these Disney animators developed and perfected that we use in our work. And again, like I said, some of these principles, they seem really obvious, but as animators, we really need to use these principles when we're creating animations. We really need to use these principles to really get what we want. Sometimes you want to pinpoint a problem, and it doesn't seem so obvious. You go through this list of principles, and then you can really pinpoint the problem. Almost everything is going to work this way, so that if you do any kind of motion, it's going to, whether, like I said, if I'm going to pick up this this water bottle here, you know, I can't just immediately go to it very quickly. It's, you know, I slow down, I speed up, I slow down a little bit. It's going to seem very subtle, but when you're doing animations, you're dealing a lot with these kind of subtleties where if you don't do it right, it's not going to look good.
I'll pick up on what Professor Philly's brought up. I was thinking that there's really two things that could be going on here. One is that you want to make the animation reference the laws of physics, right, acceleration. The other is to make the movement seem significant, feel significant to us watching. And I could see how you would want a laws of physics reference if you want a commando rushing upstairs and not getting too stretchy or too mechanical. But you want to know what the wolf is doing in a Tex Avery cartoon. It's interesting to us. It seems significant that his eyes are bulging out in a particular way. And significance sort of trumps the laws of physics there. It sounds like overall your demonstration is more about how to make the movements feel significant more than how to make it, quote, realistic.
Well, I think I'm trying to say, really, that these principles, you know, we're dealing with physical believability. You know, and also, these principles give you that physical believability, even if you deviate from reality, whether it's in games, which oftentimes you're going to have to deviate from reality in games just to make something, and I'm going to show you an example a little bit later of that, of how we might deviate from reality, but it's acceptable in a game. Or in cartoons, you're going to not deal with realistic timing. One thing, I don't know if you all are familiar with the term rotoscoping. Rotoscoping is a technique that you can use in animation where you're basically tracing reference. Same thing kind of with motion capture, where motion capture, you're capturing somebody's performance. Now, with motion capture, a lot of people earlier on were really afraid as animators, oh, you know, motion capture is going to replace us. We're not going to have work. It's not going to. Because as an animator, you know, we're doing oftentimes cartoony motions, or we can do more interesting things than you can do with motion capture. And also, motion capture is still going to rely on a good performance from somebody with all the motion capture equipment on them. You know, so we might totally, you'll find that with like real, with motion capture data and also with rotoscoping of actual movement, oftentimes you'll find that it looks really slow, even though you're really basing it on a real performance. You look at it though on a CG model, and it'll seem like, wow, that's really slow. I think we need to speed that up quite a bit, you know, to get it to even to seem realistic. Okay, to me, this anticipation, this is a really interesting principle to talk about. Anticipation is a principle that we use in animation to tell your viewer what you're going to do, basically. And almost anything you do, you're going to use, there's going to be anticipation. So I'll just give you a couple examples. If you're going to throw a baseball, then you hold the ball, and before you go forward, you're going to go back. So it's like you're going to throw a ball, you go back, and then you throw. So the going backwards, that's the anticipation in the animation. Or a golf swing. If you're swinging a golf club, you don't just do it without any anticipation. You wouldn't hold the golf club and then just hit it like that. You're going to go back first, and then you hit it. Those are just obvious examples. You can also think of a bow and arrow. That's a good example of anticipation, where you pull the arrow back. There's the anticipation. You release. Or a slingshot, same thing. But even something like getting out of a chair, where it could be very subtle, but you're sitting down, and before you get up, you go down a little bit, and then you go up. So that's what physical anticipation is. I should clarify that. We go back before we go forward, we go down before we go up. Let me show you a couple examples. Actually, I had some pictures. Oh, maybe the pictures will work. Yeah, okay, great. So here's an example of, I think this is a fantastic example of anticipation. And this is very relevant to games, although with some, I should tell you some of the problems that we as animators have with anticipation in games. But this is a great example of anticipation, where you look at this, this is a great pose. You know exactly what he's going to do. There's no doubt what he's going to do. He's going to hit the ball. And this is really good for us as animators because we're telling the viewer, we're not surprising the viewer. They know what's going to happen. They look at this and they're like, oh, he's going to hit the ball. One quote that's used oftentimes in a lot of the animation books out there and stuff I've referenced at least is something that Charlie Chaplin said. He said, first, you show them what you're going to do, and that's the anticipation. Then you do it, and then you tell them what you did. And for us in animation, obviously, clarity is really important. You want these things to be clear. So in this case, this is great anticipation. He's telling us what he's going to do. He's going to hit the ball. You hit the ball, and then this is a great pose because he's showing you what he did. What did he do? He hit the ball. But it was the first picture. That's the anticipation. And I'm going to show you an example of anticipation that, once again, I created with just a simple bouncing ball. Okay. Whoop. So there you go. You can see the anticipation, and I'm using one of the other principles for the anticipation here. I'm using squash and stretch, if you remember. So squash and stretch could be used for objects hitting another object. It could even be used, in this case, for anticipation. You can see that the ball first scrunches down and then goes up. And where when we deform a mesh like this, it might be seen as really kind of cartoony anticipation, but and squash and stretch. But if you were doing a jump, you would also have the character scrunch down before they jump up. You might. This is where I wanted to say, in a game, we do have certain constraints. So oftentimes in a game, you don't want to use anticipation. And I don't know if, do any of you know why we wouldn't want to use it? Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you were playing a game, and I think this happened to me. I was playing Prince of Persia, and there the animations were really nice. Really nice animations. Gameplay comes first, of course. Gameplay is going to trump everything in game development. So as nice as the animation was and as nice as the anticipation was in the jump, I really didn't like falling off the cliff. And that's what was happening to me. I'd press the button and, you know, right when I get to the edge, I press that button, I want to jump immediately. But I'm doing my anticipation as I'm falling off this cliff. So a game player is going to want really just to be very responsive. That's what you want with a lot of these different kinds of games, is for it to feel responsive. So you'll see in something like Jak and Daxter or Ratchet and Clank, I don't think that they use any anticipation. It's just, and it doesn't bother the player. You don't even really notice it, because you want to press that button and jump immediately in the air. Or if you're, you know, punching or something like that in some kind of fighting game, you want it to be immediate. You're not going to want this big anticipation, no matter how lovely it might be. On the other hand, I think anticipation has a really great potential in games, though, too. If you're fighting a boss character, then it's a good way of projecting to the player what's going to happen. You know, you see that boss character and he's getting ready to, you know, slam some big, I don't know, club on you or something like that. Then it's nice to have that anticipation. It's telling the player, okay, this is what's going to happen. You better get out of the way. Here's another one of the principles: follow through overlapping action. Now, some of these principles I am going to go more into depth into, and then other ones I'll just kind of gloss over very quickly. Follow through overlapping action is one that I'm not going to speak too in depth on. Follow through overlapping action is something that we use in animation for things like hair, clothing, tails, antenna. That's the follow-through. So it's something that's kind of, you're not really controlling it, but if somebody has really long hair and they're running, then, you know, the hair might kind of follow along like this. Overlapping action, on the other hand, is the successive bending of joints. So this is another one of the principles that we use in animation to make an animation more pleasing, where if I'm going to grab this bottle of water, you know, to get a drink, I could just bring my hand like that, you know, and grab it, or it's going to be more pleasing, especially if I kind of exaggerate it somewhat, not to the point where it's so obvious, but if I take it and my arm comes first, then my elbow, and then my hand. So you can take your hand, kind of go like that and grab it. That's going to be more interesting. Follow through overlapping action has a lot of use in games, because oftentimes you have tails or hair or whatever. There's that game Heavenly Sword, where I think the hair goes absolutely nuts, but you know, that's an example where you might want to use follow-through and overlapping action. As an animator, you might be responsible for animating the follow-through and overlapping action, and on the other hand, it might be driven by code. I think it's better when it's driven by code for games, because oftentimes, you don't have time for the settle. You don't have time for something to settle if you're animating it. I do have an example of follow-through overlapping action. Okay. Just an example of follow-through, where this kind of rectangular object is moving along, and then this like pendulum-like thing follows along with it. So, you know, it's pretty simple concept there. Should have numbered these. I don't even know what number I'm on as far as the concepts that I'm talking about. Next one I'd like to talk about is arcs. Most everything moves in arcs. Now, I should stress, I mean, as simple as these principles seem, when I was studying animation, you know, each one of these topics could really cover a whole class. And I don't know if you all find them as interesting as I do, but I really do find these concepts very interesting. Arcs, almost everything moves in arcs. And also in animation, we use a lot of figure eights. So, you know, hips on a walk might, you know, do kind of a figure eight. Now, this is something that you can look at in an animation, and if you're pinpointing, you know, there's a problem with this animation, then you see that things are not moving in arcs. It's just something to look at with animation. Almost everything moves in arcs of some sort. And unfortunately, the pictures work here. So here's a great example of a golf swing, and you can really see the arc that the golf club takes as this person swings it. But also hands, head, almost everything is going to move in an arc.
What's a non-arc movement?
Well, I mean, if something were to slide across a floor, obviously that wouldn't have an arc to it. You might not have an arc with mechanical type objects may not have an arc, but again, they might have an arc. So
could you do a golf swing without an arc?
I don't think so, no. I mean, unless it was, you know, a totally different kind of golf swing that, you know, some kind of mechanical, you know, contraption that hits a golf ball.
I guess my question is, how can you not do that? I mean, it's a principle, but...
Well, okay.
Something sliding... Not
gonna,
but.
Okay, the computer doesn't do the animation for you, and you know the way that we work as animators, and I'm going to talk about one of these principles a little bit later, which has to do with which is a little bit different than these other principles in that it's not so much a concept, but it's more a technique, and that's pose to pose and straight ahead, and I'll get to this topic, but I just want you to understand that, you know, the computer is not going to animate for you, and if you take the computer's results, you're going to be very disappointed in your animations. So if it's something like a golf swing, instead of it doing this nice arc, it might the computer might, especially if you're using IK to drive the limbs, instead of doing this nice arc, you might get something that's more like boom, 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 like that. You know, it's going to be very, very direct. These things, they don't just happen in the computer. You, as an animator, have to do it. You really have to, frame by frame, you have to go through this stuff. The computer is just not going to do these in-betweens like you're going to want them. And inexperienced animators first will let the computer do these so-called in-betweens, and their results just are not going to be as nice. So that's why. Now, also, I think maybe arcs, sometimes we... Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm going to have to get through some of this stuff really quickly because there's a couple things I'd really like to get to. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to skip some of these examples just so I can get through this a little more quickly and... show you another bouncing ball. Here, this ball does not have very good timing, but also it's obviously not traveling in an arc. Now, this is something that you will get in computer animation if you don't treat the keys like you want to get the result that you want to. A bouncing ball is a great example for a lot of these concepts because it's super simple. It's super easy to demonstrate these examples. Yet when you start dealing with limbs and hips and things like that, it becomes a lot more complicated. As simple as these principles seem, actually implementing them is not an easy thing. And then if we take a look at... an example where we'll see the arcs and they'll be much more pleasant. Oh, I meant to show it with the... the path there, okay. There we go. And also you can see with the spacing how since we talked about the spacing. And again, this has the same exact timing as the bad example. Same exact timing, but it's all this in-betweening stuff that's different. You can see how it comes out very fast and then it slows down as we get more and more points up there. So that's what I want to tell you about arcs. Okay. Some of these other principles we'll be able to get through really quickly. So I'm afraid I might not be convincing you all of the importance of these principles, but really they cannot be stressed enough. Another principle, straight ahead, pose to pose. Now this one I'm going to just go through really quickly. This is more a work method for doing animation. We got these two different work methods, or you can do kind of a combination of the two. Straight ahead animation is a process of a technique of animating where you don't really know where you're going and you just kind of let things happen. And that's by going frame by frame and just saying, okay, what would I do now? What would I do now? Pose to pose is a much more common method where if I want to do an animation of somebody picking up a water bottle again, you know, I do a pose maybe where they're standing here and looking at the water bottle, and then do a pose of them grabbing it and bringing it to them. Maybe I have three poses there. And then I have to deal with all the in-between stuff. But I can very quickly do an animation where I do those three poses and give it to, whether it's the scripters or designers or coders, I can quickly give it to them in this unrefined state. They can be working with it, and in the meantime, I could be refining my animation. So there's a real advantage to using pose to pose. It you get much stronger poses, and also it's just something where you can get it to a rough state very quickly to give to people that where they can do the work that they need to do. Solid posing is another one of the principles, and really it just has to do with creating a strong pose. And learning what it is that makes a strong pose is something that takes, I think, takes a while, and it's something that you're constantly working on. But obviously what you want with a strong pose is something that's clear for the viewer, clear that they can read it, kind of like that pose that I think I have it here again. Well, no, I got this. I think I got the other example somewhere else. But this is an example from Team Fortress 2, and I should just say, I mean, I just pulled this off of did a Google image search. I didn't work on this game. I wouldn't want you all to think that I did. I wish I had, because I think it's a very beautiful looking game. Really, you know, great art quality in it. But this is a really good example of a strong pose, something that you would want in animation. Very clear, you know what's happening. You see this character behind here, and you see the knife, you know, and it just, you wouldn't need to see the details. You would know what was happening here. Very strong pose. If a less experienced animator might pose it so that the knife was coming straight to the camera like this, and that's not going to read very clearly. So strong pose is a very, very important concept. Also, I think the solid posing really helps to express the mood of a character. Obviously, a tired character or a more alert character, they're going to hold themselves very differently. Couple more really quick examples. This is really good pose again from Team Fortress 2. You really get the sense from this strong pose of this character really holding this heavy weapon here. Another strong pose, just strong silhouette. When you're doing animations, you're dealing a lot with silhouettes because silhouettes are just going to tend to read a lot more clearly. You know, if you saw this character and he's posed exactly the same, but he's pointing towards the camera, you wouldn't know what was happening. So we as animators oftentimes will really try to get that strong silhouette. As I said earlier, it's a little bit difficult in games because you don't have control of the camera usually. But as much as you can, you try to get that solid posing. Secondary action, I'll just go through that very, very quickly. I don't really have any examples of it. Secondary action is a principle that is very often confused with overlapping action follow-through, even by very experienced animators, even though this concept is a concept that is totally different. Secondary action just has to do with actions that your character is doing on top of whatever their main action is. So in the case of somebody, let's say, that is impatient, and they might be saying, you know, I really got to go. They might have a secondary action where they're fiddling with their watch. Their main action is them saying, you know, I really got to go. But the secondary action is them fiddling with their watch, which is a really good secondary action because that's going to strengthen the primary action of the animation. Staging, again, this is a principle I'm going to just go through very quickly. Staging has to do with almost everything else as far as composition, lighting of a scene, color palette choice, all of that has to do with staging, which also lends to the mood. So in a game, you might have, you're going to have different lighting to set the mood, whether it's, you know, kind of an eerie, scary type of mood. Maybe you have, you know, dim lighting. If something is more happy, you might have very colorful color palette. That has to do with staging. And let's see, is that the last one? Okay, no, there's two more. Exaggeration. That one is a pretty obvious concept, I think. We as animators, and especially in games, you want to exaggerate things because you want it to be clear. So this is really an important one for games, I would say. Exaggeration as a concept, you want to exaggerate things so that they read clearly. You don't oftentimes deal with subtlety in games. Sometimes you might have an opportunity to do so, but very frequently you don't deal with subtlety. You want to exaggerate things so it's obvious. Appeal is a super subjective one. Things have appeal, but don't confuse appeal with cuteness. Appeal can be something ugly as long as it's interesting to look at. So it's a very subjective one. It's a very interesting concept, and that's primarily what we're trying to get with all our animations is appeal. Those are the principles. I wanted to just tell you about two books. In case you are interested in getting more information on these subjects, these two books are the two books that you would want, and they're going to explain this stuff in a lot more detail and a lot better than I have. This first book is called The Illusion of Life. It's written by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, who were two of the so-called nine old men at Disney. They wrote this book about these various concepts in great detail, and it's really a super source for learning about the concepts and also about the history of Disney animation. And then my personal favorite as far as books to really understand the principles of animation is The Animator's Survival Kit by Richard Williams. This is just a really great book, really shows you really fantastic examples of these principles, and also has great anecdotes in it. And just you go through this book and you actually try these exercises, go a long ways to really learning these principles. How much more time do I have?
You have like 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Oh, that's too bad. I had a couple more examples of just some jumps as I would probably do it.
I don't see anybody waiting at the door right now, so maybe you have 2 minutes.
Okay, let me just show you these really quickly. Let's see, it should be called Game Jump. I think it's got Game Jump somewhere in the... not sure. I thought it should be right here. Okay, I got some of them here, so we could take a look at this. Okay, here's a game jump as it might be implemented after I've done it. And I'd be very disappointed in the result. And I'll just give you a quick explanation of why I'd be very disappointed. Oftentimes we as game animators do not have control of the up and forward motion of a jump. So oftentimes this is what we end up with. And what's happening here is that we have a slow in coming out of the jump and a slow in as it gets to the jump, whereas you don't want that with your jump. This is how it's going to most likely be implemented when a jump is first put into a game. And this is where I think that an understanding from the programmers and the animators, when they understand each other and they understand each other's language, then they're able to pinpoint these problems and then get a better result. And the better result would be this would be a better result. Now, one thing I'll just quickly note is that I don't have the anticipation in here because, as we spoke about earlier, you wouldn't necessarily want the anticipation because you want responsiveness with your animations. And then my final example is, and I've never actually had the opportunity to do this on a game, but I've always wanted to, is the double jump. So I did this over the weekend just for the fun of it so I could demonstrate the double jump, which I think is probably the envy of all Olympic high jumpers. Yeah, that's everything. I don't know. I know we've kind of run out of time. So if any of you have any questions, you know, please, you can, as people leave, I'd be more than happy to answer them. I should have left more time for questions. Thank you.